Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Andy Bomick, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for about, oh, I don't know, maybe 5 weeks, titled Angus, Thongs, and Full Frontal Snogging, Confessions of Georgia Nicholson. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Brave Irene. And then it's Dear Librarian. Lemony Snicket, Goldfish Ghost. My favorite picture book of all time, The Short and Incredibly Happy Life of Riley. And then I'm going to read some Wallace and Ladmo Show Presents, Aunt Maud's Storybook. And if we have time, we'll finish up the first half hour with some Shel Silverstein poems from his book, Everything on It. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Brave Irene. Mrs. Bobbin, the dressmaker, was tired and had a bad headache, but she still managed to sew the last stitches in the gown she was making. "It's the most beautiful dress in the whole world," said her daughter, Irene. "The Duchess will love it." "It is nice," her mother admitted, "but, Dumpling, it's for tonight's ball, and I don't have the strength to bring it. I feel sick." "Poor Mama," said Irene. "I can get it there." "No, Cupcake, I can't let you," said Mrs. Bobbin. "Such a huge package, and it's such a long way to the palace. Besides, it's starting to snow." "But I love snow," Irene insisted. She coaxed her mother into bed, covered her with two quilts, and added a blanket for her feet. Then she fixed her some tea with lemon and honey and put more wood in the stove. With great care, Irene took the splendid gown down from the dummy and packed it in a big box with plenty of tissue paper. "Dress warmly, Pudding," her mother called in a weak voice, "and don't forget to button up. It's cold out there and windy." Irene put on her fleece-lined boots, her red hat and muffler, her heavy coat, and her mittens. She kissed her mother's hot forehead 6 times, then once again made sure she was tucked in snugly and slipped out with the big box, shutting the door firmly behind her. It really was cold outside, very cold. The wind whirled the falling snowflakes around, this way, that way, and into Irene's squinting face. She set out on the uphill path to Farmer Bennett's sheep pasture. By the time she got there, the snow was up to her ankles, and the wind was worse. It hurried her along and made her stumble. Irene resented this. The box was problem enough. "Easy does it," she cautioned the wind, leaning back hard against it. By the middle of the pasture, the flakes were falling thicker. Now the wind drove Irene along so rudely, she had to hop, skitch, and go helter-skeltering over the knobby ground. Cold snow sifted into her boots and chilled her feet. She pushed out her lip and hurried on. This was an important errand. When she reached Apple Road, the wind decided to put on a show. It ripped branches from trees and flung them about, swept up and scattered the fallen snow, got in front of Irene to keep her from moving ahead. Irene turned around and pressed on backwards. "Go home," the wind squalled. "Irene, go home." "I will do no such thing," she snapped. No such thing, you wicked wind. Go home, the wind yodeled. Go home. It shrieked, or else. For a short second, Irene wondered if she shouldn't heed the wind's warning. But no, the gown had to get to the Duchess. The wind wrestled her for the package, walloped it, twisted it, shook it, snatched at it. But Irene wouldn't yield. "It's my mother's work," she screamed. Then, oh, whoa! The box was wrenched from her mittened grasp and sent bumbling along in the snow. Irene went after it. She pounced and took hold, but the ill-tempered wind ripped the box open. The ball gown flounced out and went waltzing through the powdered air with tissue paper attendants. Irene clung to the empty box and watched the beautiful gown disappear. How could anything so terribly wrong be allowed to happen? Tears froze on her lashes. Her dear mother's hard work, all those days of measuring, cutting, pinning, stitching. For this? And the poor Duchess. Irene decided she would have to trudge on with just the box and explain everything in person. She went shuffling through the snow. Would her mother understand, she wondered, that it was the wind's fault, not hers? Would the Duchess be angry? The wind was howling like a wild animal. Suddenly, Irene stepped in a hole and fell over with a twisted ankle. She blamed it on the wind. "Keep quiet," she scolded. "You've done enough damage already. You've spoiled everything, everything." The wind swallowed up her words. She sat in the snow in great pain, afraid she wouldn't be able to go on. But she managed to get to her feet and start moving. It hurt. Home, where she longed to be, where she and her mother could be warm together, was far behind. "It's got to be closer to the palace," she thought. But where any place was in all this snow, she couldn't be sure. She plowed on, dragging furrows with her sore foot. The short winter day was almost done. "Am I still going the right way?" she wondered. There was no one around to advise her. Whoever else there was in this snow-covered world was far, far away and safe indoors. Even the animals in their burrows. She went plodding on. Soon, night took over. She knew in the dark that the muffled snow was still falling. She could feel it. She was cold and alone in the middle of nowhere. Irene was lost. She had to keep moving. She was hoping she'd come to a house, any house at all, and be taken in. She badly needed to be in someone's arms. The snow was above her knees now. She shoved her way through it, clutching the empty box. She was asking how long a small person could keep this struggle up. When she realized it was getting lighter, there was a soft glow coming from somewhere below her. She waded toward this glow and soon was gazing down a long slope at a brightly lit mansion. It had to be the palace. Irene pushed forward with all her strength and slosh, thrump, she plunged downward and was buried. She had fallen off a little cliff. Only her hat and the box in her hands stuck out above the snow. Even if she could call for help, no one would hear her. Her body shook, her teeth chattered. Why not freeze to death, she thought, and let all these troubles end? Why not? She was already buried. and never see her mother's face again? Her good mother, who smelled like fresh-baked bread? In an explosion of fury, she flung her body about to free herself and was finally able to climb up on her knees and look around. How to get down to that glittering palace? As soon as she raised the question, she had the answer. She laid the box down and climbed aboard. But it pressed into the snow and stuck. She tried again, and this time, instead of climbing on, she leaped. The box shot forward like a sled. The wind raced after Irene, but couldn't keep up. In a moment, she would be with people again, inside where it was warm. The sled slowed and jerked to a stop on paving stones. The time had come to break the bad news to the Duchess. With the empty box clasped to her chest, Irene strode nervously toward the palace. But then her feet stopped moving and her mouth fell open. She stared. Maybe this was impossible, yet there it was, a little way off and over to the right, hugging the trunk of a tree, the beautiful ball gown. The wind was holding it there. "Mama," Irene shouted, "Mama, I found it." She managed somehow, despite the wind's meddling, to get the gown off the tree and back in its box. And in another moment, she was at the door of the palace. She knocked twice with the big brass knocker. The door opened, and she burst in. She was welcomed by cheering servants and a delirious duchess. They couldn't believe she had come over the mountain in such a storm, all by herself. She had to tell the whole story, every detail, and she did. Then she asked to be taken right back to her sick mother. But it was out of the question. They said the road that ran around the mountain wouldn't be clearing till morning. "Don't fret, child," said the Duchess. "Your mother is surely sleeping now. We'll get you there first thing tomorrow." Irene was given a good dinner as she sat by the fire, the moisture streaming off her clothes. The Duchess, meanwhile, got into her freshly ironed gown before the guests began arriving in their sleighs. What a wonderful ball it was! The Duchess, in her new gown, was like a bright star in the sky. Irene, in her ordinary dress, was radiant. She was swept up into dance by handsome aristocrats who kept her feet off the floor to spare her ankle. Her mother would enjoy hearing all about this. Early the next morning, when snow had long since ceased falling, Mrs. Bobbin woke from a good night's sleep, feeling much improved. She hurried about and got a fire going in the cold stove. Then she went to look in on Irene. But Irene's bed was empty. She ran to the window and gazed at the white landscape. No one out there. Snow powder fell from the branches of a tree. "Where is my child?" Mrs. Bobbin cried. She whipped on her coat to go out and find her. When she pulled the door open, a wall of drift faced her. But peering over it, she could see a horse-drawn sleigh hastening up the path. And seated on the sleigh, between two large footmen, was Irene herself, asleep but smiling. Would you like to hear the rest? Well, there was a bearded doctor in the back of the sleigh, and the Duchess had sent Irene's mother a ginger cake with white icing, some oranges and a pineapple, and spice candy of many flavors, along with a note saying how much she cherished her gown and what a brave and loving person Irene was. which, of course, Mrs. Bobbin knew better than the Duchess. Dear Librarian, hello, readers. And this is from Ira Glass, who is the host and executive producer of This American Life. I make a radio show. We do stories about all sorts of people. One of our producers, Stephanie Fu, loves libraries so much that she made a story for the radio about someone named Lydia. Lydia had a pretty life, changing experience in the library, and when we told our listeners, they went wild for it. Bananas. You get the idea. They really liked it. Afterward, Lydia wrote her own version of the story, and that's the book you're holding in your hands. I think I need to mention here that, like Lydia and Stephanie, I am also a massive, hardcore, nonstop, colossal library fan. When I was little, on one of my regular trips to the Baltimore County Public Library, I discovered there were books that teach magic tricks. That totally blew my mind. These incredible secrets were just sitting on a shelf for anyone to learn, for absolutely free. I started performing magic shows, like for money, real money. I did this for years. It taught me how to speak in front of a crowd and all sorts of other skills I use on the radio every week. Also, I can still make a coin vanish. Here, watch this. Okay, it's gone. Tough. Maybe you didn't see that. I swear, in between writing down these words, I really made it disappear. If you and I meet someday, I'll do it for you in person. Till then, I hope you like Lydia's story as much as our listeners did. Ira Glass, host and executive producer of This American Life. Dear librarian, may I tell you a story? It's about me, and it's about you, and it's about my library home. It happened when I was 5 years old. Me and my mom and my dad and my five big sisters and one baby brother all had to leave Colorado and go to Iowa, where Grandma was. My dad needed a new job, and we needed a new place to live. In Iowa, I missed my little blue home with the big maple tree. I missed my red roller skates packed away in the big truck. I missed my sunny backyard with lots of space to run and play. I missed my best friend, little Becca. But most of all, I missed having a home. In Iowa, I didn't have a home to live in, just houses. Five big sisters and one baby brother and a mom and a dad are a lot of people, so we lived in a lot of different places. Some days, we lived at Aunt Linda's house. Aunt Linda had a pretty pink bathtub for fancy bubble baths. But Aunt Linda's house was full of nice things. Nice things you shouldn't touch because they aren't yours. Some days, we lived at Cousin Alice's house. Cousin Alice had her own family to take care of, but she let us sleep in her tiny, cozy basement. In Cousin Alice's basement, there was a big couch and bouncy mattresses. Every night was a giant sister sleepover. Move over! You're hogging the blanket. That's my spot. But even a snuggly sleepover was a little too crowded for all of us. Some days we stayed at Grandma's house. Grandma lived right by a park with swings and space to run and spin. But there weren't any friends at Grandma's park. Grandma's house was too small. Aunt Linda's house was too nice. And Cousin Alice's house already had a family. Nowhere was home. Nowhere had a special spot just for me. Then one day, Mom took me and my five big sisters and one baby brother to a new place. Not a house, but a big building with stone columns and tall, tall steps. And this was the public library. The library! There was a sunny window that took up a whole wall. There were rows and rows of books and baskets of toys and a puppet theater. There was so much to do and so much space to do it in. At the window, I could watch people on the street, or I could skip down the rows of books with my brother, or I could make up stories with my sisters. There was enough space at the library for all of us. Then I found a special spot just for me. Up the tall stairs, across from the sunny window, was a round desk. It was my favorite spot because behind that desk was my new friend. She had kind eyes, a gentle face, and a laugh like bubbles. That friend was the librarian, and that librarian was you. You looked me right in the eyes and listened to me like I was a grown-up. You helped me find a book about princesses, and then you sat down on the floor to read it to me. After that, Mom and Dad brought me to the library all the time. Every day you gave me a hug. Every day you made me feel safe and happy. Those days, the library was like a home, my own special home, even though it wasn't a house. Later that year, my mom and dad and my five big sisters and one baby brother all went to live in a big brown home with a tall willow tree. I could zoom around in my red roller skates again, but I still visited my library home to be in my favorite spot and read books and to be home with you, my library friend. Now, my dear librarian, I'm a grown-up, but I still go to the library every day because I'm a librarian, just like you. You gave me a library home, so I wanted to make one, too, for kids with little blue homes and big brown homes and no homes at all. So I did. Dear reader, this book is based on what really happened to my parents, my siblings, and me when I was a little girl. For 6 months, my family stayed with various loved ones while we were homeless and looking for our own place to live. Homelessness affects around 2.5 million children every year. Many go years without experiencing a stable home life. Each child faces different challenges. Each child has their own individual story. My experience was unique to me alone. I am now a children's librarian in Wisconsin. In 2018, with the help of the radio show This American Life, I reunited with the librarian I wrote about in this book, Deb Stevenson. I thanked her for inspiring me, and it was truly one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Maybe there is a librarian in your life who has inspired you, too. If so, tell them, and maybe give them some chocolate. We usually like chocolate. If you would like to learn more about libraries and the work librarians do, please visit the American Library Association at ALA.org. Happy reading. Lydia Sigwarth. Lemony Snicket, Goldfish Ghost. Goldfish Ghost was born on the surface of the water, in a bowl, on the dresser, in a boy's room. For quite some time, he stared at the ceiling. The boy's room was pleasant and familiar, but there was nobody there to talk to. So, Goldfish Ghost floated out of the bowl and drifted toward the window to find some company. Outside the window was a seaside town. It had a fishing pier, a row of shops, a sandy beach, and a lighthouse everyone said was haunted. At the pier was a great mess of birds who were all excited about the fishing boats. It was interesting to hear them shriek, but they paid no attention to Goldfish Ghost. They were not good company. When the wind changed, the birds moved on, and Goldfish Ghost let the breeze take him into town. The streets were busy with interesting-looking people buying sweaters and postcards and pets and groceries, but everybody there was with somebody else, so no one was looking for company. Goldfish Ghost followed a rattly jeep full of loud music and found himself at the beach. None of the bathers even gave him a glance. But floating over the water were the ghosts of creatures who had lived in the sea. They were all very interesting, but Goldfish Ghost did not feel quite at home on top of the ocean. It can be hard to find the company you are looking for. Goldfish Ghost rested atop a breech umbrella and wondered what to do. Eventually, it got late, so he decided to head back to the bowl. Another goldfish was there, but she was not a ghost. She seemed nice enough, but she was not good company, and the moon called Goldfish Ghost back out the window. "I've been looking for company," said a voice. It was the ghost of the lighthouse keeper, who had been watching him from the lantern room. "Do you live here all alone?" asked Goldfish Ghost. "Not anymore," the keeper said, and she took him in her quiet hands and placed him where the light had once shone for sailors at sea. The two ghosts settled in together, looking out quietly at the world. They were very good company. And I want to finish up the first half hour of today's program with my all-time favorite children's book titled The Short and Incredibly Happy Life of Riley. Riley, who is a rat. Everyone wants to live forever. They want to be happy and healthy. Some of these things are actually quite difficult, but some of them are really easy, which might seem surprising because most people hardly manage any of them, at least not all of the time. None of this bothered Riley. Riley had been born happy. His earliest memory was being with his brothers and sisters and mom in a big bed with plenty of food and no rain. He was always happy, even when he was asleep. He was beautiful, and everyone loved him. He was the best, and so were his brothers and sisters and mom. All Riley wanted was some fruit and maybe a couple of slugs on Tuesday or Friday, or now and then. People, of course, want more than that, which is a shame, because it's about all you need, apart from a cup of tea and some toast, and maybe not the slug. People want double fudge, chocolate, caviar sausage, gourmet, jumbo size, baby, cow, sheep, chicken, with extra thick whipped cream and MSG sauce burgers, some of which is gross, some cruel, and most unhealthy. All Riley wanted was a little stick with a pointy end to scratch the bit of his back he couldn't reach himself. People, of course, want more than that. They want microwave, video, DVD, SMS, internet, big car, cost more than yours, gold, diamond, electronic, gigabyte, fastest, biggest, and smallest machines. People, of course, should never be able to have sticks with pointy ends because they stick them into each other. Riley looked in the mirror and didn't think anything. There he was, not too big, not too small, simply himself, Riley. People look in the mirror and get very depressed. They want to be taller, shorter, thinner here, but much bigger there. Curly, straight, younger, older, less spotty mustache, smooth skin, golden sun, tan, gorgeous, irresistible, not bald and famous in a painting. The only place Riley ever wanted to be was here, which he always was. People, of course, they want to be everywhere. They want to go to the seaside, ski resort, paradise, dream world, castaway, exclusive, you must be really rich if you can afford to come here, plaza, luxury, get away from it all, anywhere but here, theme park. Riley fell in love with the first girl he met. He thought she was perfect and the most beautiful girl he had ever seen. They had lots and lots of perfect children and all lived happily ever after, except Kevin, who got hit by a bus, but was still happy because he never saw it coming. People fall in love all over the place. They fall in love with themselves and as many other people as they can. They want to spend the rest of their lives for at least a month with the most beautiful, funniest, curviest, clever, but not as clever as me, exciting, I wonder what I ever saw in him, her, my wife, husband, partner, dog doesn't understand me, do you come here often? Anyone, everyone in the world. And one of the silly things about life is that people who spend so much time not eating what they really want, in places where they don't want to be, with people they don't like, usually live for quite a long time. Whereas Riley, who spends all the time eating his favorite food in his favorite place with his favorite friends, only lives for a very short time. This is why it's never a good idea for people to compare their lives to animals. You will only end up feeling depressed. Because realizing that rats have a better life than you do is really, really sad. And the answer is very simple, really. You just have to be happy with a lot less. Release your inner Riley. Okay, and this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for about 6 weeks, titled Angus, Thongs, and Full Frontal Snogging, Confessions of Georgia Nicholson. I am a facsimile of a sham of a fax of a person. Georgia Nicholson's life is far from simple. Her cat, Angus, is the size of a small Labrador. Her 3-year-old sister may have peed somewhere in her room. And her best friend, Jazz, thinks she looks like an alien just because she accidentally shaved off her eyebrows. Enter the sex god. this just might turn out to be the most fabbity-fab year ever. Confessions of Georgia Nicholson. Okay, last week, the sex god heard that Elizabeth told her friend Jazz not to go out with the sex god's brother Tom because he works at a grocery store. Now, the sex god Robbie wants nothing to do with Elizabeth. Her friends passed around a paper rating their face features, and Elizabeth and Jazz are now arguing about the results. And that's where I left off last week. 7 p.m. In my room, in front of the mirror, practicing smiling without making my nose spread. It's impossible. I must never smile again. 8 p.m. Phone Jazz. Jazz, you only gave me a 7.5 for my figure, and I gave you 8 for yours. Well, I only gave you 8 because you are my friend. Well, I only gave you 7.5 because you are my friend. I was going to give you 7. Midnight. How dare Jazz only give me, what was it? 8 for my eyes? I gave her 8 for hers, and she has got stupid brown eyes. 1 a.m. That Beth stupid Morgan can only have given me 4, 3, or 0 for my nose. I gave her 6.5 for hers. And I was being very bloody generous when I did. What is the point of being a nice person? Thursday, November 26th, 9 p.m. Vatty dropped a bombshell today. He is going on a trip to New Zealand because M and D are thinking of going to live there. I don't know why they bother to tell me. I don't really see what it has to do with me. It was just as I was on the dash to school, and Vatty said, Georgia, I don't know if you have heard anything, but there's been a lot of redundancies at my place. I said, Vatty, don't tell me you are going to have to go on the dole with students and so on. You could always sell your apron if we get too short of money. Monday, November the 30th, 4:20 p.m. Jazz still moping about Tom. We have to avoid his part of town now. I hope I'm not going mad, but Rosie told me that she draws stuff on the roof of her mouth with her tongue, like a heart or a little house. I said she was bonkers, but now I've started doing it. 5 p.m. Bumped into the boy up the street I met at bonfire night. We sat on our wall for a bit. It's funny. He's one of the only lads I don't feel like I should rush off and cover myself in makeup for. I don't even flick my hair so that it covers half my face, and therefore half my nose. Dad says if I keep doing it, I will go blind in one eye, and also that it makes me look like a sheepdog. But what does he know? And anyway, it won't bother him in New Zealand. Bonfire boy is called Mark, and I suppose the reason I'm not too self-conscious in front of him is that he has a huge mouth. I mean it, like Mick Jagger. He's about 17, and he goes to Parkway, the rough school. He's mad about football, and he and his mates go play in the park. I think I've seen them when I've accidentally taken Angus for a walk up there. He's sort of quite attractive, Mark, not Angus, despite the mouth. He wants to be a footballer. He has got a tryout somewhere. When I left, he said, see you later. Oh no, here we go again on the see you later trail. 9 p.m. Saw Mark walking down the street with his mates. He looked around and up at my bedroom window, so I had to bob down quickly. I hope He didn't see me because I had an avocado mask on and my hair cellotaped down to keep my fringe straight. I wonder where he's going. He had trainers and jogger bums on. 11:30 p.m. Heard Muddy and Vatty arguing. Oh, perfect. Now they'll split up and they'll both want custody of me. 10:40 p.m. If I go with Mom, I will have access to makeup, clothes, and so on. And I can usually persuade her to let me stay out later. She laughs at my jokes and goes out a lot. On the other hand, there is Vatty. 10:42 p.m. Ah, well, bye-bye, Vatty. December. The Stiff Dylan's Gig. Tuesday, December 1st, 11 a.m. Mucho excitamondo. There is going to be a Christmas dance at Foxwood School. Slim announced it in assembly. Girls, there is to be a dance at Foxwood School to celebrate Christmas on December 12th, commencing at 7:30. Me and Rosie and Jazz and Ellen went, ooh, ooh, oh, oh, for so long that Slim had to say, settle, girls. At last she went on. To add to the festivities, there will be a band. We started doing our oh again, but Hawkeye glared at us so viciously we stopped. I had thought of shouting three cheers for the headmaster of Foxwood and three for Merry England, but I didn't. Slim still hadn't finished. The band will be the Stiff Dylan's. Lunchtime, 12:30 p.m. Jazz and me had a confab by the vending machine. Jazz said, do you think we should go? I mean, Lindsay will be there, and Tom might. Well, he might go with someone else, and then we'd be like two spare wootsits at a wedding, I suggested. 4 p.m. The most cringe-making thing in the universe of cringe-making things happened this afternoon in religious education. It was with Miss Wilson, who is not what you might call normal, still, who would be teaching RE. She is a very unfortunate person with ginger hair in a sad bob. Her tights are always wrinkly, plus she wears tragic cardigans, usually done up the wrong way. She is not blessed in the looks department, and worse than this, she has not got a personality at all, none. Mostly, she just talks, and we get on with writing notes to each other or filing our nails. Last summer, Rosie was so relaxed that she started moisturizing her legs during RE. It was so hot that we hadn't been wearing stockings, and Rosie put her legs on the desk and started putting cream on them. Well, even Miss Wilson noticed that. I remember she said, Rosie, you'd better buck up your ideas and buck them up fast. Which struck us as very funny indeed. We were still laughing hours later. Anyway, this afternoon, for some reason, Miss Wilson got talking about personal hygiene. I swear, I don't know how she got there from religious education. Maybe people in ancient Hebrew times cast someone out for being a smelly leper. I don't know. We just heard her say, yes, girls, I know how that person felt because when I was younger, I had a BO problem myself, and people used to avoid me. I never used to wash because I was an orphan and depressed. We just sat there staring at our desk while she went on and on about her body odor. It was awful. I have never been so glad to get up and go to PE. We all ran screaming into the showers and washed ourselves like loonies. Miss Stamp was amazed. She usually has to prod us and shout at us to get us to change at all in winter. She came and looked at us in the shower in amazement. Then we remembered she is a lesbian. So we ran screaming out of the shower. It's a bloody nightmare of pervs, this school. You'd be safer in Borstal. 8 p.m. Jazz came over for the night. We yattered on about a plan for the school dance. 9 o'clock p.m. Looking through my bedroom window to see if we could see into next door's bedroom window, because I wanted to know what Mr. Next Door wore to bed, Jazz thought gym jams, and I thought shorty nightshirt. Then, as we were looking, we saw Mark, bonfire boy, coming up the street with a girl. They stopped under a lamppost, but I couldn't see what she looked like as they were kissing. Not in the shadows or anything, but under the lamp. We couldn't stop watching. And to get a better view, we got up onto the window ledge. It was a tight squeeze, but you could see everything. Then I heard tip-tap, tip-tap, and Libby came in, carrying her blanket, or blanken, as she calls it. It's not actually a blanket. It's an old bra of Mom's, but she likes it and won't let it go. It must have been white once, but now it's a horrible gray color. She spotted us on the window ledge and said, "Libby, see." I said, "No, Libby, I'm coming down." But then she started saying, "No, no, bad boy, me see," and hitting me with her blanken so that I had to lift her up. Honestly, I'm bullied by a three-year-old and a Scottish wildcat. Well, I lifted her up, and she snuggled down in between me and Jazz. She spotted the couple under the lamppost. "Oh, look, man lady, ha, 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 ha." It was a bit difficult knowing where Mark ended and the girl began. But all was revealed when Mark stopped kissing and looked over her shoulder. Right up at my window. I don't know if he could see us in the dark, but we got down from the window ledge so quickly we fell onto my bed. Libby said, "More bouncy now." Pray God Mark didn't see us spying. Wednesday, December the 2nd, 8:30 a.m. Dashing out of the house, Jazz and I almost fell into Mark, waiting by the corner. Jazz, big pal, said she had to run to her house first, and she would see me at school. I went a bit red and walked on with him, walking beside me. He said, "Have you got a boyfriend?" I was speechless. What is the right answer to that question? I tell you what the right answer is, a lie. That's the right answer. So I said, "Yeah, I've just come out of a heavy thing, and I'm giving myself a bit of space." He looked at me. He really did have the biggest gob I've ever seen. "So, is that no?" And I just stood there, and then this really weird thing happened. He touched my breast. I don't mean he ripped my blouse off. He just rested his hand on the front of my breast just for a second, before he turned and went off to school. 12:30 p.m. What does it mean when a boy rests his hand on your breast? Does it mean he has the mega horn? Or was his hand just tired? 4:30 p.m. Why am I even thinking about this? No sign of Mark, the breast molester, when I got home, thank goodness. 4:45 p.m. Still, you would think, if a boy rests his hand on your breast, he might bother to see you sometime. 5 p.m. Up in my bedroom, doing my homework, when the doorbell rang. I put down my magazine and answered it. It was Mark. He said, "I've dumped Ella. Do you want to go to the Stiff Dylan's gig?" I said, yes, thanks." He said, "Okay, see you later." 6 p.m. On the phone to Jazz, telling her about Mark, I said, "So then," I said, "yes." And he said, "Okay, see you later." Jazz said, "See you later. What does that mean?" I said, "I don't know. Who does know? See me later tonight? Or at the gig? Or what?" Jazz said, "Well, do you like him?" I thought about it. "I don't really know. He makes me feel like a cobra, you know, all sort of funny and paralyzed when the bloke starts playing the bugle thing." Jazz said, "What do you mean? Your head starts bobbing around when he plays his instrument?" I said, "Don't start, Jazz. Anyway, what do you think of him?" Jazz thought, "Well, he's got a very big mouth." I said, "Yes, I know." And then she said, "But then, so have you." Midnight. Uh-oh. What to do? Why is life so complicated? Do I like Mark? Why did I say yes? Why can't Robbie realize that Lindsay is a drippy git? Oh, que damage. Merde, poo. Monday, December 7th, 5 p.m. Mark sent a note, which is quite sweet, except that it's very badly written. "Dear Georgia, anyway, training till Saturday. Meet you at 8 at Clock Tower on Saturday, Mark." That's it then. I have no choice. I have to go with him. 9 p.m. Mom comes into my room and says I will come down for a talk. I pray it's nothing to do with personal hygiene or her and Dad's relationship problems. Dad seems a bit nervous, and he's growing a mustache. How ridiculous. It looks like some small animal is just having a bit of a sleep on his top lip. He says, "Look, Georgie, you're a young woman now." What was I before, a young horse? "And I don't think there should be any secrets in our house." "Yeah, on the contrary, Vaddy, you will never know about the hand-on-the-breast scenario, even if hell freezes over." Which is why I need to tell you that as work is so hard to find here in England, I am flying off to Auckland straight after Christmas. I'll be staying there for a month or two to get a feel for the place and to try a new job opening there. Then, when I get settled, your mom and you and Libs can come out and see what you think. I said, "I know what I think of New Zealand. I have seen neighbors." Mom said, "Well, that's set in Australia." What is this, a family crisis or a geography test? I went on patiently. My point is, Muddy and Vatty, that it is very far away. I'm not from there. All of my friends are here. Or, to put it another way, I would rather be adopted than set foot on New Zealand soil. We argued for ages. Even Libby came down and joined in. She had dressed Angus up in her pajamas, and he had a bonnet on and a dummy in. I don't know how she gets away with it. If I went anywhere near him with a bonnet, he would have my hand off. Midnight. So Vatty is off to New Zealand. But that still doesn't solve what I am going to be wearing for the Stiff Dylan's gig. Friday, December 11th, 2:50 p.m. Christmas fever has set in at school. We all wore silver antlers in physics this afternoon. Herr Kamer tried to join in with the joke by saying, "Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells." It's pathetic, really. Also, why are his trousers so short? You can see acres of pale, hairy ankles between his trousers and his plaid socks. Yes, I did say plaid socks. Now that is not just sad, it's double sad. 8 p.m. Muddy and Vatty, strangely quiet and nice to each other. I saw Dad put his arms around Mom in the kitchen. Also, Libby was singing, "Dingle balls, dingle balls, dingle all the way." And Dad got all sort of wet round the eyes. Honestly, I thought he was going to cry, which would have been horrific. He picked her up and hugged her really hard. Libby was furious. She called him bad, big, ugly, bad, and stuck her finger in his eye, which made him cry properly. Saturday, December the 12th. The Stiff Dillons. 7 a.m. Damn, I didn't mean to wake up so early. Still, it gives me lots of time to get ready for tonight. I thought first of all I would do my yoga, which I haven't been able to fit into my busy schedule. 7:20 a.m. Now I know why I don't bother with yoga. It's too hard, that's why. When I did dog pose, I thought I'd never be able to get up again. I'll just have a lie down and relax with an uplifting book for a few minutes. 7:40 a.m. I'm not reading the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying ever again. I'm not going to become a Buddhist. If I might come back reincarnated as a stick insect. 7:50 a.m. Cup of milky coffee and toast. Yum, yum, yum. Mom has got a new Cosmo. 8:10 a.m. Back in bed for a few minutes. Read, what men say and what they mean. 9:30 a.m. If a boy says see you later, it might mean leave me alone. It was great while it lasted, but I'm not ready for anything more serious. Or it might mean see you later. 9:40 a.m. I am going to become a writer for Cosmo. You don't have to make any sense at all, or maybe I'll be a bloke. They don't have to make any sense either. 10 a.m. I am going to wear my short black Lycra dress. Jazz has already phoned 5 times and changed her mind about what to wear each time. And unfortunately, this is where I might have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everybody to tune in next week when I continue with the novel Angus, Thongs, and Full Frontal Snogging, Confessions of Georgia Nicholson. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.